listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Saturday, October 26, 2019. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola, and I'm coming to you from the very cold Chicago suburbs. At least I think it's cold. I appreciate you for joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. You may visit my website at spingola.com. You may access the radio schedule page by clicking on the radio schedule page, excuse me, at spingola.com. If you wish to ask questions or comments during the program, email comment at spingola.email. I only use this email address 3 hours a week during the program. Join others in the chat room at spingola.chatango.com. And, of course, the archives are located at spingolaspeaks.net and republicbroadcasting.org. My guest today is John Klychek. Hope I'm not mispronouncing the name. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. His website is schoolworldorder.info. And let me immediately make a correction. You may purchase the book at Amazon. Purchase the book from Trinday. They have published some absolutely incredible books. This book came out on October 8th. I feel it's an honor and a privilege to interview this wonderful author. But the book, under product detail, says 96 pages. That is incorrect. There are 499 pages. So, please don't think you're just getting a measly 96 pages when you purchase this book. It's available in Kindle and paperback, but also support the website, Trine Day, and purchase it at the website because it's a good idea to support the website. And as I mentioned, Trine Day has published some absolutely incredible books. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Deanna. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. And how about you?
I'm okay. It is Klychek, just so you know. I mean, just for other people, but that's no biggie. But yeah, cause I always tell the students, if you ignore the C and just look at it, it's just how it looks. So it's Klychek, but thanks again for having me. Yeah.
Oh, your book is marvelous. It is just a marvelous book, and of course I'm going to have it in both versions. I like to have the digital version also, because then I can highlight and I can just, I don't know. I just like the digital version, but I like the hard copy too. So I love books and I like to be educated, and your book is just, it's marvelous. It's just marvelous, marvelous, marvelous. And I think that everybody should read your book. Absolutely. Everyone should read your book. And your website, as I mentioned, schoolworldorder.info, where you can read some things about the book you've written. You also write for several websites, which including Intrepid Report, The Dissident Voice, Op-Ed News, News with Views, Natural News, and you're the director of writing and editing at Black Freighter Productions. I'm just delighted to have you on the program. I love your book. I just love your book, okay? It's a fabulous book.
Cool. Thanks a bunch. And it did grow. It grew as I wrote it, and so that's why the page numbers are different. But I will say 100 pages of those are actually endnotes. So like, you know, bibliography, citations, which on the website, I'm still working on getting all the links up, are interactive. So you can actually go and just click on the links to those sources if you're interested in where I got the information from. And then there's a glossary because, you know, there's some $10 words in there. So really the read itself is only 350 pages, which is, you know, I think, you know, reasonable. It's not super duper long. It's more than the 90. So I think it's, you know, yeah, it's a readable book. If you can get through it, you can read it in sections. It's written in ways so that, you know, you can take breaks on it if you need to. But great. Thank you.
You brought up something else that I think any good book should have. If your book does not have an index, I don't think it's a complete book. Every book should include an index, and it should include citations, okay? Every book should have citations, which, of course, you have provided, and it's just a fabulous book, and I can't say enough good things about it. As I said, you have to have citations so that people can look at what you've written, and then they can look at the endnotes, which are, I think, just as important as the text itself. You can look at the endnotes and the book and go to those websites or those citations and gain the same truths. People who write without putting citations in it is just hearsay. Unless you cite your sources, you have written a book with that just is hearsay, and so you've given the complete picture. I can't say enough about the book. It's just written so well, and so what else can I say? Try and Date is a fabulous job, and has some really great authors, including our guest today.
And Chris did a great, my publisher, Chris Millen at Trine Days, he's awesome. And, he did a great job laying it out and, you know, and including an index and all those citations and,
right.
The format, the layout, everything is great on that. Yeah.
It's perfect. It's perfect. But of course you've provided all those citations and everything, but the layout is good. The introduction is great. I can't find a single thing wrong with this book. As far as the presentation, the information, not that I'm an expert, but I consider myself well-read, and your book is terrific.
Well, thank you. I tried to take an academic approach to what is otherwise considered sometimes taboo in academia, so it does, you know, I guess go into the world of conspiracy theory, I guess is the term they use to ad hominem sometimes nowadays, but you know, just some of those angles in the mainstream that they don't get covered, I guess, is a better way of putting it. But I made sure to cite, you know, academic journals, peer-reviewed journals, government citations, you know, you know, mainstream news to buttress whatever other leads I had. So, you know, I appreciate the acknowledgement of that. That you know, it is a part of it. But I try to still make it accessible to, you know, everyday people and everything. You know,
sure.
So hope, you know, it should be readable and all that at the same time. Right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, it is.
Yeah,
absolutely. So, anyway. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, I the book probably has like two main sections, and then the third one could be that angle that I just talked about, you know, if you wanted to add that to it. But the two main aspects are the privatization, of public education, okay, which involves what they call school choice is the buzzword, which largely means replacing, academics with, workforce training, okay, and then the other element of that means to remove, elected school boards and replace them with what are effectively corporate unelected councils. I think you're in Chicago as well, so we actually have the opposite kind of thing going on with, we have a new school board maybe that's gonna go about, so that's, I like the prospects of that, you know, there's a lot of controversy around it, but elsewhere, you know, for in Chicago there's been a growing trend of, right, privatization, corporatization of charter school, and one of the bigger states to kind of push that movement. But those are the two main aspects of the first part. And then the other part is basically, the technocratic implementation of the privatization, which basically just means, replacing, human teaching, human instructors, human interaction with, what we'll call adaptive learning software, which would be the teaching machine, what Skinner called the teaching machine, B.F. Skinner. And then the data mining of students to basically evolve that technology into artificial intelligence and other stuff along that line. That's probably a big mouthful. I should probably pause for a second there, yeah?
No, it's okay. The big mouthfuls are really good. I really appreciate big mouthfuls. As you said, we both live in the Chicago area. In fact, we have a common area code. So you might be in the next town as far as I know. But anyway, you talk about the use of technology rather than real life teachers. And I've done several programs recently regarding the use of technology, and really it is not as effective as having an interactive human being talking to another human being. It is it does not teach the students linear thinking. There's no really interaction. It is just the technology, whatever they're using, whether they're using iPads or some other device, is just not productive as far as developing a person's mind, and which is very troubling to me, incredibly troubling, because you really don't have the ability to interact. You're just being fed all of this information. And when you take people out of the process of any kind of human interaction, you really have to question what are the objectives here. And you certainly laid them out. And you talk about, you talk about a lot of things in your book. And I do encourage people to visit your website so that they may understand exactly, well, I want them to buy the book, of course, and that website again is schoolworldorder.info. And you've talked a lot about Anthony Sutton and of course, Eisenbeit, Charlotte Thomas, Thompson Eisenbeit, who I have interviewed in the past. And, yeah, she's very, very cool lady, very wonderful lady. And of course, I have her book, as well as, Anthony Sutton's book. So how did all this start? You want to go back, a few generations and talk about John Dewey? And some of the stuff, this didn't happen overnight. Okay?
Yeah, absolutely, sure. And actually, let's jump back there. So that, because that's another mouthful. the computers, okay, you mentioned that it doesn't engage higher thinking, I will say, right?
Right.
That's because it's largely built on what is essentially called the stimulus response psychological method. You go far enough back to where it starts with Wilhelm Wundt in the late 19th century. That's basically what his term was for. He founded the first laboratory for psychological experiments as an academic science, as opposed, you know, before that, psychology was essentially a subdiscipline of philosophy. And so Wundt basically made it a laboratory discipline where he sort of removed the spiritual or metaphysical aspects of the old psychological philosophy, because that's what it means, the study of the spirit. And pretty much just said, well, you can kind of, you can't get a hold of that and measure it empirically. So, well, what we can do is by inference measure it through people's behaviors, and people's behaviors can be controlled through this method of stimulus response. So you experience something, that's the stimulus, whatever it is, and then that triggers a particular response. You know, the most famous or common example of that would be Pavlov's dog. People probably remember, you know, you ring the bell.
Sure.
In association with the food, and then, right, you can make him salivate even when there's no food.
Right.
Today, you know, it's evolved into more terms like behaviorism or operant conditioning. That would be B.F. Skinner. And B.F. Skinner basically created the first what's called the teaching machine. And his would have been analog, and they didn't have really digital computers at the time. If you can look at the Smithsonian website, and they got pictures of them. They look like those. Remember those ViewMasters where you would put the little pictures, the Disney pictures,
and you turn,
that's kind of the same mechanism. It'd be like on a wheel, you know, question answer on a wheel. You pull a gear, you write an answer, and then at the end it gives you some kind of score that would track you into whatever, you know, academic class hierarchy you're supposed to be in. So that's kind of where it starts, and it evolves through, you know, from Wilhelm Wundt to people like G. Stanley Hall, and then, as you said, John Dewey, later John B. Watson, E.L. Thorndike, and then, you know, eventually B.F. Skinner. And all along, what you have is what I'll call the hidden hand of the Order of Skull and Bones, which pulled in Sutton, who you mentioned, Anthony Sutton. Was friends with Charlotte Thompson Iserby, and was also friends and I guess you could say research partners with both Chris Milligan, my publisher, and Charlotte. And what
right.
Sutton was the one that discovered that, yeah, behind the scenes were people like Daniel Coit Gilman, Timothy Dwight, Andrew Dixon White,
right,
during the sort of the beginning with Horace Mann. Alfonso Taft, and then moving up through the ages, you have McGeorge Bundy actually funded B.F. Skinner's stuff when he was dean at Harvard, and then you have Mr. Mnuchin now. Mr. Stephen Mnuchin is now the Treasury Secretary, and the book touches on how some of the tax cuts kind of are made to incentivize automation through a thing called the full and immediate expensing clause, which basically means that if you, you know, you can write off depreciation over time is the standard way that businesses operate when they buy equipment, but full and immediate expensing clause attached to the new tax cuts enable the company to write off all of the depreciation in the first year. So in other words, if you buy something that can automate your workforce, you can essentially get it for free because, right, you can write off the full depreciation. So kind of incentivizing that. And he basically Paul Ryan said that he was influential in helping with that tax cut bill. I know I just said a whole bunch. I feel like I talked way too much there.
No, you've talked. No, that's why you're on the program, is to talk and tell us what's in the book, and people will want to buy this book. Trust me, listeners, you need to purchase this book. Okay, we'll be right back in 3 minutes. With you and me,
It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
Oh, excuse me. Alrighty, we are back with our guest today, and that guest is John Klychek. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. And there's one thing that I want to point out, of course, and you probably already know this, but Bill Gates Foundation, donated, and this can be found on page 11, over $137 million to the Chicago school system. That's just to one school system. And that was to initiate and to reform, to invest in various charter school reform programs and initiatives that led to the creation of several successful small and charter high schools in Chicago, according to the Gates Foundation press release. Now, what I want you to know, and I received this information from other guests on the program, is that Bill and Melinda Gates have not allowed their children to have access to an iPad, iPhone, any of that stuff, the technology, until they were at least 14, either 14 or 16. They didn't want their children's minds messed up with technology. They wanted their children to understand life as it was happening, people to people, not people tied up, addicted, if you will, to the technology that they were producing and spending $137 million just in Chicago. Their own children, they didn't want to do that to. Okay, so you really have to question their values. You have to question what the heck they're doing, why they're doing it, and of course, with the foundation money, they do expect to get that back by way of programs and whatever else they have in mind as far as their objectives. And these objectives started a long time ago when school politics, school decisions used to be local. And then you had back in 1910 or right around there, you had the Rockefellers came in and they wanted to take over. They wanted to federalize the school system. They took over a lot of various organizations, historical societies and that kind of thing, to alter history and to give us a picture of the world as far as they were concerned. Okay, we're back with our guest, and thank you so much for being on the program. It's such an honor to have you on the program.
Oh, it's an honor to be here, and I've been so busy. I had no idea that you and Charlotte knew each other too. It's an extra honor to be with you than if you're friends with Charlotte, for sure.
Well, I've interviewed her. Half her book. I had all of the private files that were associated with that book. I just have a lot of information, a lot of the information that she collected and put together, and bless her heart for doing all of that. My gosh. It's wonderful that there are people who care enough to share what they have learned. You have an obligation to share what you have learned with other people. And sometimes other people are not appreciative. I've had some guests on the program, they write a book and they say, gosh, you know, nobody seems to appreciate what I've done. We should appreciate the people who give of their time, their energy, their resources to produce information for the benefit and the help of other people. And that's certainly something that you've done, certainly something that publisher has done with the many great books that Trine Day has put out.
Oh, yeah, and that's really how the book really got started, was Charlotte reached out to me. I wrote an article during the time that you probably remember when in Illinois, for those that aren't in Illinois, we didn't have a budget for almost 2 years, I think. My reading of it was that, you know, it was an attempt to basically bankrupt public education to create an opportunity for privatizing through all the school choice, charter schools, vouchers, tax credit for tuition expenses. And when that happened, I noticed a lot of the buzzwords that Charlotte warned about, you know, as like school choice, cradle to career, workforce training. And I noticed that Rauner was big in that, and that was kind of what I had deduced. And I wrote an article, and Charlotte immediately reached out to me. And sounds like we got a break. Let me pick that up.
Fabulous. Yeah. All righty. We'll be right back in 3 minutes with our guest.
Stay. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me.
We are back. I just love that song. It was actually a listener contributed that song, and I just love the thought behind it, and love listening to it. Okay, my guest today is John Pychak. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. The website is schoolworldorder.info. You may purchase the book there from the publisher, or publish it from that other place that people get books and, well, everything that people buy from that site, because we're all used to immediate gratification, and y'all know which site I'm talking about. Anyway, what is going on in Chicago now with this strike is just unbelievable. I think probably a lot of folks around the country may not know about this strike, but I think what the heck is going on? It's disrupting the children and their pursuance of an education. It's all about money and the teachers funding their pensions, and in Illinois there's quite a problem with pensions, and of course it's all money based. And if you want to cover that, or if you want to say any more about that, it's just maddening. The whole thing is really ticks me off.
Yeah, I am actually an adjunct professor at, if your listeners don't know what that means, it's the kind of the business world of academia means that you have a handful of full-timers, like any company, right? And then you have, a very large base of what they call part-time workers. And the fancy word for a professor at a college who is part-time is adjunct. And I didn't talk about any of this in the book because, you know, I was really more concerned about school governance, and also the curriculum, the technology, the future, and the direction of, you know, where the actual art of learning and education is going. I mean, I'm kind of with a master's degree. They usually want a that's my degree. They usually want a PhD. So, I'm kind of in this weird niche, which has its perks because I'm not stuck in a lot of that administrative stuff. I don't have to do a lot of, that type of stuff. So I get to teach and, I get to have that buffer. And then, you know, I try to do the stuff that I can, you know, on my own with the book and the writing as far as my activism for education. But I would say that I haven't followed it deeply because of that. I've been focused on this, you know, this book and
trying to,
but I would say that, yeah, I did notice that, a lot of the focus just from the blurbs I see on the news is, yeah, I hear a lot about the teachers getting paid, and you know, that's why I mentioned the stuff about, you know, when you're part-time, you don't make a lot of money. You know, I have to work at two schools. Most people teach three classes. I teach six, and then I tutor on online sometimes. I tutor at other places. You know, I bounce around and kind of hustle. So I guess if anybody would complain about money, I might do that, but it's not on my radar. So it does. That does kind of strike me as odd. I mean, I would say that, yeah, it seems to be more kind of political battles over where money's going to go and who's going to get paid is largely what it looks like from a very outside perspective. Yeah.
Right. And it's the children who are suffering and their parents. I think the majority of parents work outside the home, so it's putting a great stress upon parents to find a place for their children during the day. It's just very, I don't know. Why didn't they do this in the summertime?
There's another, that's another, you know, possibly to stir up more attention, you know, I mean, who knows, you know, I mean, how people strategize some of this political stuff. And you know how Chicago politics is not always the cleanest, you know, so.
Oh gosh. Oh my gosh.
But one thing I did notice, you know, and again, this is from just looking at headlines, okay, but I did notice, I think, in one of the things they wanted more was improvement in school climate and I think I want to say it sounded like socio-emotional learning
is
what it sounded like, a buzzword for that, like more support staff for that type of stuff,
right?
Yeah,
it didn't have anything really to do, or it doesn't seem to have anything to do with that, about providing the children with more education. It just seemed to want to provide more nursing staff, more staff to address other things that parents should be taking care of. The other thing that really bothers me about the system is that parents should be taking care of their children's daily needs. They should be feeding them. They should be taking care of their children. The school systems are not in charge of feeding people, okay? They should not be in charge of feeding people. That's a parental job. And I think when I was going to school, I went there to learn to read and write, and I learned something. It was up to me to do my homework. It was up to my parents to feed me. It wasn't up to the taxpayers. I think students took more responsibility for their homework, for their education. It's actually the child's obligation to learn. It's the teacher's responsibility to provide the children in a classroom with a specific subject or subjects. And then the parent's job is to provide the child with a home, with food, with shelter, with clothing. And now all of a sudden you have the government interloping on those parental responsibilities, which is taxpayer funded, of course. Oh, this is totally wrong. Okay, I've had my little rant.
Oh, I thought we were getting ready for a break. Okay. Yeah, so, there is an emotional element to learning. I'll say that because I tutor, and sometimes as a tutor, the student is not yours, they'll open up to you in different ways. And a lot of times they're intimidated and they have a bad experience with all the stuff we're talking about in school, right? I mean, which is largely, you know, stimulus response conditioning.
It's right.
I incorporate a lot of John Taylor Gatto stuff, and he talks a lot about, you know, the systematic humiliation and otherwise, you know, caste system that is
right.
The process of learning your place in the intellectual hierarchy, so to speak. You know, I have a lot of students that when I tutor them, you realize that they say, oh, I'm overthinking it. Yeah, you're overthinking it. You're freaking out. I get it. And by the way, I did really good in college, but I did really bad in high school. I was one of those kids that, you know, was always in trouble and stuff like that. So I know what it's like to be on both sides of it. But to your point, you know, learning is supposed to be the cultivation of the higher mind, and a lot of what the socio-emotional stuff, and by that I mean the cultivation of the higher mind, and it's the use of it to integrate whatever are your, you know, your passions, your emotions, your fears, your anxieties, those two things go together. But it's the student's responsibility to do that, with help, obviously. But if you constantly try to make it too easy, or make it easier, or be this intermediary, you're largely just, as you say, you're taking the responsibility out of them, and true learning doesn't happen unless it's on your own. You know, a teacher should just be somebody that kind of points in the direction.
A facilitator, absolutely. I was a big fan of John Taylor Gatto, the late. He passed away about a year ago. And, almost exactly a year ago, October 25th.
Oh, it's Charlotte's birthday. I'm sorry I cut you off. It's happy birthday, Charlotte, into the world for Charlotte. Happy birthday, Charlotte.
Yes, happy birthday. We should sing a song. Well,
I think so.
We'll just pretend like we sang a song.
Okay.
Happy birthday. And bless her heart for her work and the time that she has spent, because people spend their time doing, writing things to help others, and I just appreciate that so much.
I was gonna say, and you know, in memory of John too, I feel like I just cut John off. John, you're remembering John but I didn't want to forget that. I'm so sorry about that.
No, it's okay. We're both on the same page. We're just, yes, absolutely. So there's so many things going on. I do hope people will purchase your book. So we've got, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Interloping they are involved in so many things, nefarious things that we could go into, but just the fact that they have touched on the education of American students is enough to really ask questions. And you talk about Bruce Rauner and just all the stuff that's going on in Illinois. And a lot of times we think, well, if things happen in California and then they move eastward. But Chicago has always been the hub of a lot of other really nefarious activities. And certainly it seems to have retained to be the center place for a lot of corruption and organizations that seem to fan out here in the middle of the country, elsewhere. And, Bruce Rauner sounded like he was going to do this really good job. And gosh, he got elected. And then I don't know what happened to him. He just, I don't know. As you said, politics in Chicago, is very questionable all the way around from the beginning. But he also made several donations and gifts to the schools. Oh, and then we have this recently where these high-profile actors and people which has nothing whatsoever to do with your book, but buying their children's influence or paying their children or paying other people to take classes or take pictures. It's horrible. It's just horrible what's going on. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, because I remember you mentioned that, you know, a lot of the big tech guys, folks, I guess, Bill and Melinda and, you know, Steve Jobs, I believe, they prefer to not, have their own children, use too many devices, we'll just say. You know,
Steve Jobs is the same way.
I talked about that in chapter 4 or 5, off the top of my head, I can't think which it is, but it's big data, billionaire Bessie and the public-private planned economy.
Oh yes, we have to talk about DeVos. And their little secret combinations and what they were doing.
Oh yeah, and in there I talked about, I just mentioned this contradiction, right? I mean, it's, you know, everything you hear, you know, sometimes I get invited to just regular academic conferences and emails and you look at, well, what's the venue? And it's all the stuff that's in the book, you know, adaptive learning, predictive analytics, maker spaces, workforce schooling, all that type of stuff. But it's a lot of high tech stuff, you know, and then you look in the meat, well, the people that make it don't seem to utilize it the same way they want us to, which is always never a good sign, right?
Right. It's a bad, bad sign when they won't let their own children have access to this stuff. And, it's a very bad sign.
Google is the name of the big one where a lot of the Silicon Valley people send their kids. It's the
right.
Board of school, yeah.
Yeah, they all know in Silicon Valley exactly what's good for children and what's not. And parents ought to be emulating the parents in Silicon Valley and asking questions. But they're so busy paying taxes for school, for schools and all the rest and trying to earn a living and take care of the families, while the so-called rich and super rich are really producing a workforce that will enable them to continue their lifestyle, which is quite different than everybody else's lifestyle, to be sure.
Yeah, you mentioned, I was in prep, I was looking at some of, I've been listening to your radio show just to get a feel of how you do things, and, you'll remember his name. The book is Digital Cocaine. What's the man's name?
Oh yes, Huddleston.
I hadn't thought about a lot of that. Didn't really know about it, but it fit perfectly in. And he talked a lot about just the frequencies of the technology. I talked a lot about the stimulus response in terms of how it's designed to play on the human reward and punishment centers to get you to behaviors that are, you know, suitable for workforce training. Right. But he talks about just how the frequencies themselves rewire your brain at a different level. And I've noticed how certain light frequencies, they give me a headache. And so, it's just kind of speculating on that. They know that at two levels, at the cognitive, behavioral, and at the biological level, that those computers are shaping the kids' brains in different ways than a paper and pencil.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. All righty. We will be back in 3 minutes. All righty. We are back. We are back, and our guest today is John Klychek. And he is the author of this really fabulous book, and the name of that book is School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. And it is available at the website, schoolworldorder.info, and of course at that other site that we all use to fulfill our immediate gratification needs. In 2012, I had a guest on the program, Dr. Samuel Milham, and we talked about electricity at that point in time, and I did a rebroadcast of him just about exactly a month ago of that broadcast. And since then, I've used Graham Stetzer filters on many of the outlets in my home. I'm very cognizant about the dirty energy, dirty electricity, and that's one problem. But as you mentioned, Brad Huddleston, who I had on October 5th, after reading his things, looking at his videos, and understanding the full impact of what technology is doing not only to children, but to adults, I was overwhelmed. I was just, it put a whole new slant on everything. And, it was a shock to me. It really was. And then the following week I had on, William Cadwallader. And he talked about StopDirtyElectricity.com. So we do have people who are writing about dirty electricity. We have people who are writing about the problems with technology and what it's doing to the brain, what it's doing to the mind. And some people have this faulty vision or this faulty view that somehow the government, the ABC agencies, that they think are protecting our rights and protecting us from all of these things, are really not. They are really protecting the corporations. And it's the corporations that you talk about in your book, the corporatization of education. My gosh. They've gone after the adult population. They've gone after the children, in their corporatization of education. And it used to be that children didn't go to kindergarten. They were home for a very long time. I didn't go to school until I was 6 and a half, just because of when my birthday was situated and the time of the year that I was born. And the fact that kindergarten just wasn't all that popular. But now they want to take... Oh, okay, we'll be back. We'll be back momentarily. Stay with us. Back 3 minutes. All righty. We are back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is John Klychek. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. And I was going on a little rant right before the top of the hour break. But now they want your children preschool, and they just want to take over the children. And I love children. My own children are the joy of my life. And it just really makes me mad that they're doing all these terrible things to children. Children deserve the best that we can give them, not to be corporatized and used and abused by the very system that should be protecting them and educating them to be productive citizens in society, not some sort of workforce that can be exploited by corporate America.
Yeah, interesting thing about the idea of kindergarten, for those who might not know, is that that comes out of a Prussian military system of schooling, largely inspired by Johann Fichte, who was close to the real Illuminati, the historical Illuminati, the Bavarian Illuminati founded by Adam Weishaupt. And another member of that would have been Karl Casimir Wundt, who was the father or grandfather of Wilhelm Wundt, who was the psychologist who I earlier mentioned, who basically started this stimulus response form of psychological conditioning that is largely now synonymous with educational theory. I think it's like over 600. It might be more than that. I've got a chart in my book. It's actually Anthony but it's the number of PhDs that got, American PhDs that got their doctorate under, Wilhelm Wundt and brought it back to America, largely under the aegis of, G. Stanley Hall, and then later John Dewey and all the other.
Right. Yes, this doesn't happen overnight. This has been incremental, and it's certainly been planned, plotted. I know that sounds very conspiratorial, but that is the facts.
And that's why I touched on that angle. I mean, the book could have been complete and possibly equally, or not equally, but in almost equally informative without looking at the order, maybe. But if you take that element out, you can always come up with the counter argument that, oh, this is just this natural process of evolution, which is what, the post-humanist, the transhumanist, which I get into that in the end, that's their argument, which is that, that basically evolution once was this biological form of mutation, your DNA through competition with other species, evolves, it gains an advantage, and then it keeps that genetic advantage, and then it gets another one, and that has largely been replaced now with technological evolution. So when our brains became smart enough to manipulate the environment to our advantage as opposed to manipulate our own biology to our advantage, that took over, and that later, that at one point we will interface with these ever evolving technologies, which are now computational. If you take this consistent element of the order of skull and bones out of the equation, that could possible maybe, but if you add that to it, it certainly at least complicates that argument. It certainly looks like there's a certain elite group of people who are trying to create the new man in the new world, which would be, starting from Weishaupt and down to today. So that's why I touched on that. My colleagues in academia might poo-poo that, it's not academic to go down that route, but, how many correlations do you have to do before you can actually, confidently infer that this is something to look at, is how I look at it, so.
Absolutely. And of course, as you mentioned, there are, the Order of Skull and Bones. A lot of our politicians belong to that order or to other orders. They're all working together, the Democrats, the Republicans. They pretend like there's some sort of a choice. They make the public think, oh, you can vote either Democrat or Republican, and you're going to get the same thing no matter what you vote for. They all go out, they're in on this together. Nobody's draining the swamp. they're adding to the swamp. If you take a look at some of the leadership in some of the agencies, the ABC agencies, and recognize that there is a revolving door between government and the corporate world, then there's going to be a big problem because there is a revolving door, and we need to recognize that. And of course, if you look at, if you get people, most of the time get their news from the very limited source. There's five entities, media entities, that are producing the exact same news, which is fluff and stuff. And they really don't give us the news about what's really going on. But people get into this and they think, oh, this is what's going on, and isn't it wonderful that fire, the fire engine came out and retrieved six ducklings from some hole, a manhole. That's not news. I'm sorry. It's just not news. And we don't get news. We're just being programmed, which is unfortunate because not only are they programming our children, but they already have the adult population largely programmed and continuing. Now they're just starting earlier and using more technology and replacing, the work that people used to do, production. And when you're producing something, when you're actually contributing to society in some meaningful way, then you're going to feel really pretty good about yourself. But when production has been offshored, put into countries where the labor is a fraction of what it is here, well, it's pretty bad. We're painting kind of a negative picture here, but this is what's going on, and you can't avoid looking at the truth. And you certainly have not avoided looking at the truth, okay?
And, you know, there is something to be said for the argument that, or at least a kernel of truth in this argument, that why aren't students getting jobs after they get out of college, right? So you spend, especially if you spend a lot of money going to college, you know, I mean, it's pretty normal to feel like, I thought I was supposed to get an advantage after this, not have debt and make the same amount, that other people without degrees are making. Sometimes those people make more. I have plenty of good friends who, very good friends, don't have, actual college degrees. Some of them don't have high school degrees. They make good money. They make better money than me, you know, and so it crosses my mind sometimes. But that's not the point of education. I mean, if you know, in the classical world, you know, education was largely to make you, you know, the liberal arts was what it was called, was to make you liberal in the sense of being free, right? Being able to think on your own. If you just wanted to be secure in your economic situation, you could go to the guild, or you could go and get, largely what is now workforce training. But that didn't necessarily give you the same advantages in terms of mobility in the larger civil process, you know, and so it didn't give you the ability to think outside of your guild caste, so to speak. So in today's world, you know, I'm not saying that there should be no, you know, if somebody doesn't want to get a master's or a PhD, there should definitely be a way for them to do some kind of vocational ed or something. But what I kind of look at with the new trend is that, you know, the old voc ed, you know, or even like, you know, a traditional apprenticeship, you largely learned a skill. You know, my old man was a carpenter, is a carpenter, and, you know, he largely learned that stuff, just not in a traditional apprenticeship, but you studied under, as you worked, and, you know, was able to, do okay for himself, you know. But there was a skill that he has, you know, if something's messed up around the house, he can do it. In the new workforce training, which you largely have is, you're trained for a particular, not just a particular job, but a particular company, you know, is the long-term goal. They call these career pathways, and they're largely, a lot of times, funded by, sponsored by particular companies. And so, you know, over time, the trajectory looks more like you are you know, basically being trained for a workforce caste system. You're not, it's not even that you're being educated with a vocational skill that you can use autonomously and, you know, make your own way as an entrepreneur, so to speak. And that, in my opinion, is the pernicious part of, you know, the career pathways, workforce schooling through this, you know, what they call the adaptive learning, software, et cetera. So, you know, I mean, yeah, that's the, right. That's what I think is the difference, I would say.
Right. And the school system, when I was in high school, we learned how to do a lot of practical things. There were sewing classes, there were cooking classes, there were classes where you learned how to take care of your needs. And now, I watch commercial television. I think that I, well, it's like a lawyer who prepares the opposite case. What you see now is that you would think that no one knows how to cook, because now you can get all of these prepared meals that you just follow the directions and cook. And I'm positive people are being overcharged. Well, of course they're being overcharged. But I think, what's the matter with these people? You just look at a cookbook, darn, and you follow the directions, and you teach yourself how to cook, but the practical things that we learned through our experience and through our education are no longer available to children. They do not know how to do these practical things, to take care of a household, to take care of things that we just normally learned through life. And it's amazing to me that people, it is just totally amazing to me.
And not only do they not learn it, and you know what, I'm guilty of this in a lot of ways myself, because I don't know which generation I am. X or millennium. I'm probably in the middle there somewhere. But, you know, I am not proud of I can do some stuff my dad used to do, you know, handiwork wise, but I, you know, I'm not the handyman that he is. You know, and back, you know, that would have never been, the case, you know, once upon a time. You know, you would have at least absorbed what came before you. But it's not just that they don't, that we, myself included, don't necessarily learn all the time, but, you know, there's this, at a deeper level, oftentimes, it's not valued. It's not valued. The whole idea of the workforce training or the automation of work itself is based on this principle or this, you know, I guess, anti-value, what I would call an anti-value of, you know, work is bad, constantly trying to get away from work. You know, having economic security with a particular company, you know, with your workforce or your career pathway certificate is not going to necessarily fulfill you as a human creature, in the same way as if you actually have a relationship with the fruits of your labor. In other words, like you're creating something that when you're done, you're proud of what you created, aside from the money. Obviously, everybody wants to pay their bills, you know, but they both have to happen. If you're just paying your bills, but you don't really have any treasure, you know, in the stuff that you produce with your hands or your labor, like that's not healthy either. That's not what we want either. So, you know, both the workforce training curriculum and also the idea of auto, like you said, with the little bit of free time I have, I like to do stuff. You know, I like to pretend like I can mess around with some woodworking like the old man, or I like to try my hands at, you know, crafts and things. And, you know, that's just something else that the underlying value was wrong before they even tried to put it all together, you know.
Right. And the other thing about technology is that it is altering children's language skills. They have developed a whole new set of text patterning where they, well, they're not even teaching cursive writing in some areas. They're not teaching those basics that people should know, should be expected to learn. They are not using their hands, their, I just can't believe it. What is going on? It is just unbelievable to me. Go ahead.
I try not to be too controversial in the classroom, but we talk about, you know, all this data stuff for sure. I mean, we got to talk about that, you know.
The right.
No, I don't bring up the order, you know, unless somebody on the side is like, you know, somehow comes up. But, you know, that I largely give them stuff that's, you know, and I try to give it to them in an even-handed way and make a, one of the articles, it's a, was it The Atlantic? I think it's The Atlantic. It was Nicholas Carr. It's his Google Making Us Stupid, and it's all about whether or not, Google is altering our reading patterns, our comprehension abilities, and then I give him some other stuff on texting. You know, we look at Orwell sometimes, you know, and his ideas about how language would be diminished and things. We talk about that a lot, and I notice, you know, I mean, just as an example, some, you know, sometimes I'll come in the classroom and they tell them, see, that's it, you know, I'll turn the lights on, you know, if I'm not here before class starts, but they'll sit in there a lot of times with no lights on, and everybody's looking at the glowing phone. And then when it's time to take notes, you know, I put stuff on the board. I'm old fashioned. I still use the whiteboard. You don't have chalkboards anymore. I got whiteboards, and I was a marker board. And, they'll snap a picture at the end. And I tell them, I said, look, cause the administration doesn't necessarily encourage us to tell them to not use the phones, and whether they know it or not, because I get along with a lot of administration. I'm actually friendly with a lot of people. I'm a pretty agreeable person. Whether they know it or not, you know, they got a job to do too. They're trying to play their position and make the people above and below happy. And, you know, they might think that's all they're doing, but, you know, when I look at a couple steps up, it's like you are basically encouraging this trend. And that trend is to interface with these technologies. And I used to joke and say those things are going straight in your brains, kids. I shouldn't say kids, because most of them are adults. I teach college at 18 to some are older than me. It's community college. And you know, now they actually have, these brain computer interfaces with, you know, Neuralink at, Elon Musk's company and Facebook's got.
All right. Yes.
You know, and that sounds crazy, but, you know, when you actually, that's why the book got so big, because I thought that was going to be just kind of all like this little thin part of the book, and I realized, well, you know, they've been playing with that stuff for like 50 years, with, you know, starting back in Yale again, which is where the order is. I know I trailed off there. I had two things going, and then I took a detour, and I didn't get back.
It's okay. It's okay. Yes, people actually used to write things down. And when you write things down, it goes into your mind much easier than if you take a picture of something with your smartphone or your whatever. I don't use a cell phone. I have one. It's turned off. And I used to, I think I used it maybe 3 months ago. I was out somewhere and I wanted to stop by my friend's house and I called her to see if she was home. It could have been 4 months ago. I do not use a cell phone. First of all, they're, because a lot of health issues, serious health issues. Okay. We will be right back in 3 minutes.
With you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you.
All righty, we are back with our guest, John Klychek. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. And right before the break, we were talking about taking notes versus taking a photo of what's on the blackboard or whiteboard.
Yeah, you saved me on that. That's what I wanted to get back to you. What you mentioned was that, right, if they write it down, they will remember it better than if they snap a picture. And I try to, like I said, I always try to not impose on anybody. So I tell them, you know, hey, if you want to snap your picture, snap your picture. But I'm going to encourage you to also write it down because, you know, this is where the neurological stuff is true. You know, it's just that you should be in control of your own psychological and neurological conditioning. And I tell the story where I used to compete in some martial arts stuff, and I ran out of wind a lot. And a coach, a trainer told me that to write down every night that I don't get tired. I thought it was the silliest thing. So I'm like, I says, Joey, I'm not going to be able to, you know, writing this down isn't making my, it's not going to make my lungs bigger. I don't know what kind of voodoo you're trying to help me out with here, but it worked because, you know, it puts it in it, that subconscious, that value level. And what it helped it with was when I got tired, instead of telling myself I was tired and giving into it, I did the opposite. So just anytime you're scrawling though, you know, there's kinesthetic research that suggests that the connection, that pencil to the hand, it's better than typing the notes as well, by the way. I say that as well. It has a deeper connection to that memory center of your brain. Okay. And so, you know, just to end that, it's not that the science is untrue. It's that it's being used in the wrong ways. You know, I mean, you and I are using, you know, technology right now. It's just that I think it should have its appropriate place and should not, largely override, you know, the human mind and what I believe is the human spirit. You know, that's where I stand.
Right. Something that you said I was going to pick up on and add some things. Certainly we do use technology, but you should make that technology as try not to rely on technology, but rely on your brain, because if you don't use it, you'll lose it. And I really believe that is what is going on. The other thing too that I wanted to get back to, a thought that I had, was that people actually believe, I assume they believe, that somehow that Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and these people somehow just developed this technology, these technological ideas in their garage. If people actually believe that, you really need to question their sanity. These people had some connections, and I've studied the connections that Bill Gates had and the connections that his father had with questionable entities. No, these people didn't just start this stuff in their garage and become millionaires within a relatively short period of time. You can say the same thing about Facebook. You can say the same about all of the big Google and all of that. This sounds conspiratorial, I know, but people, that just didn't happen. They had big money behind them. They didn't do this in their garage. They didn't become overnight successes by doing something in their garage. Sorry, if you believe that, that's pretty naive on your part. The other thing that I wanted to touch on, something you touched on, was the medicalized education, which is something else that is very troubling, is that somehow teachers now have this unique ability to be able to say, oh, that child must have ADHD because look at him. He's so full of energy. Well, it used to be that we had several periods. They called them recess. They called them gym. We actually went outside. I grew up in California. We could go outside every day and have recess and run off all that energy. We played baseball. We did all kinds of things during PE. And boys are more fidgety. And most of the time, you'll find that there are more boys on Ritalin and who have been, who other professionals, quote unquote, have determined that, oh, they have some mental problems. Okay, we will be right back in 3 minutes. Alrighty, our guest today is John Klychek. He's the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. The website that you want to visit is schoolworldorder.info. When we went to break, I was talking about ADHD and that also goes back to centralized education, wherein the government has actually, by federalizing education and putting it on a national scale, has placed themselves in a position where they can offer extra money for children who have some sort of disadvantage or some children who have some problem where they have to have medication. And of course, since the federal government is one of the biggest consumers of this kind of medication, and they now have another group that they can practice on in addition to the military and in addition to institutionalized folks, such as prison inmates, then it just, gosh, it just makes it so much easier for the people who are supposed to be representing us in Washington to make a little extra money. They go to Congress as regular folks wanting to do something really great and with good intentions, and they come home as millionaires because they know exactly where to put their investment funds and stocks and whatnot. But you talk about I was just mentioning medicalized education, which also goes back to Bush, because they started a program, clinical trials and that kind of thing, in Texas when he was governor down there, of using and he worked in hand in hand with the Clintons on this. So that they could get more people on drugs. So you have drugs and technology, both bad for the children of America and for adults.
And technology as a drug, basically.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's kind of what Mr. Huddleston mentioned, but also, the medicalized part of it stems again from the stimulus response psychology. So largely the stimulus once upon a time would have been, you know, whatever instructional material whoever's the teacher would present. So, you know, text form, and then, you know, as audiovisual media progresses, you know, maybe a video or something like that. And then the response is the outcome that you want the student to get. And this is a pedagogy. That's a fancy word for philosophy of teaching. So if I accidentally say that too many times, but pedagogy means philosophy. Fine. Teaching, but so this teaching philosophy, where largely you're providing some stimulus to get a particular outcome, like, and the outcome is predetermined, right? Usually in line with some workforce training, you know, for national, you know, economic development, etc. The medicalized part, I mean, in some ways, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy is itself a medical practice, but there's the deeper level with the socio-emotional learning, or the acronym is SEL, where largely what they want to do at this point is take the stimulus response to the neurological level. And so that means that they're tracking how your nervous system responds, as opposed to, like, how do you perform on the test? These otherwise abstract, aggregated behaviors. They're largely looking at They have something called Effectiva, which is it's a product that will face scan you if you're while you're learning. I saw one with it's on RT with the BrainCo Corporation, which is also in the book, where they're either scanning the face and they're looking at your facial expressions to look at how the students are learning. Are they engaged? Are they happy? Are they paying attention? And then there's also the BrainCo has like headbands, I guess you would call them. They're little halos that sit on there, and they measure the EEGs, right? So the brain waves basically, and you know, how are those responding to the lesson plan? And then the Gates Foundation was at one point trying to fund these bracelets, the GSR.
Oh, right.
The yes. Galvanic Skin Response, I think is what it's called.
Yes.
And so that would do the same thing. It looks at skin conductivity, heart rate, and they're looking at all of these physiological responses. They're aggregating it into some kind of algorithm. And then, you know, you're going to be, your lessons will be, if you're the student, your lessons will be altered accordingly, right? So, you know, if you're not responding properly, the lesson will maybe be made easier for you or you'll get some other accommodation would be the fancy word they use for it. So that's the medical part. I mean, it's not just the using, you know, getting students on ADHD meds, but, they literally have, they call it gamified learning. The product escapes me at this moment. I can look it up at break. It is basically a learning game or a video game that trains you to have better to treat your ADHD, to have better focus. And a company that actually focuses a lot on that is called NeuroCore, which Betsy DeVos has lots and lots of money invested in. She might even be one of the main investors or shareholders. I'll look that up at break as well, the particulars. But she definitely was a big thing when she got when they brought her in to be secretary, when they voted on her. That was one of the things. I think Lamar Alexander and some other people, some other congressmen had said, hey, you have to divest this if you're gonna be secretary of Ed, and she hasn't. And they also have they have NeuroCore Pro. Now I've since checked that since I wrote the book, and that the NeuroCore Pro website, I haven't been able to find it. So I don't know if they shut down that branch of it or what they did with it, if they're just doing some PR on it or something, but there is an educational arm of it, which is NeuroCore, is to help treat ADHD, and you know, it's kind of what they would call gamified learning or conditioning your reflexes through this digital stuff that monitors. They call it biofeedback. Okay. And that's all the, your stimulus response, your neurological stimulus response and how that works. But they also have the corporate arm, which is, you know, they'll help like athletes or like business people who need to focus, you know, need to focus their mind when they're at some kind of, board meeting or, you know, you're under pressure, under some kind of psychological stress, you need to perform better on the job. So, you know, easily a company like that can obviously put those two together, and you can have, you can pathologize the workforce now and give them some sort of medicalized treatment to make them, perform better in their workforce cast is kind of what I infer from all of that. Yeah.
The other thing too, and, what previous guests and you have indicated is that first of all, you should never put any child in front of any kind of a screen. And people when television became very popular, television is not interactive. Television is just, you are just taking in information that people, you have no idea who they are, have devised. You do not interact with the TV. When you read a book, you are interacting with what you are reading. When children used to listen to serial radio programs, they used their imagination to interact with what they were hearing. But when you put somebody in front of a screen or put a screen in front of people, there's no interaction. There's no stimulation. There is just people being fed a particular pieces of information that they take in. And you can say the same thing about YouTube videos. Yes, there's probably a lot of good information in YouTube videos. I don't spend a lot of time looking at YouTube videos because none of them have citations. You don't know where the information came from. You're just taking in this information. Your brain is not really questioning or interacting with that. So that children in a classroom who are just being fed information don't have any, they're not participating in what they're getting. They're not raising, you don't raise your hand to a screen and expect to have some sort of a communication about what's being presented. You're expected to accept that information, questions, no questions allowed. And I believe that in that kind of a situation, you're not going to be stimulated. You're going to get bored, whether you recognize that it is boredom. It's just not interactive. And if you're not participating mentally in something, then it's probably not very good for you.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a neuroscientist, and I'm not a psychologist. I teach English. I'm a specialist in rhetoric. But, right, psychology comes out of philosophy, and rhetoric is philosophy. And if you even look at something like, you know, Freud's idea of the mind, you know, he had the id, the ego, and the superego. Well, that was just ethos, logos, pathos, right? And so, you know, that's just the thinking part of the mind, the feeling part of the mind, and then the doing part or the will. And, you know, you don't have to necessarily have a sophisticated degree to understand that learning requires the proper balance of those things. And that means that you as the student with a guide have to be responsible for, using the higher part of the mind, the logos, to largely integrate or otherwise control the pathos or the feeling part. If you use this what they call the cell, the socio-emotional stuff, like you said, there's no learning happening. You're basically just downloading information. I mean, it's almost like a digital lobotomy. I tell my students that there's, you know, especially when they have to write a topic or they don't like any of the topics that might be out there. They're just as an example. I said there's two parts to good learning. One is fun, hopefully, to creative, it's the play where you experiment and stuff. You entertain your own curiosities. But there's another part that is the discipline part, which is the part where any high level of achievement is going to require some hard work, and that's never fun. I've done martial arts for 20 years, and so I also have a lot of experience with the part of that art is that, you know, it's fun to maybe grapple or maybe do some sparring or do some creative stuff, but you only get to have fun and do that if you're in shape and if you work on your tools over time, and that goes for your whole life. You know, those things will at some point get rusty if you get lazy on that. And so, you know, if you're always trying to make it, if these technologies are constantly trying to get rid of the difficult part where you have to kind of sweat or where you have to, you know, do a little bit of, you know, suffering, you know, self-guided suffering to find some higher state of awareness, consciousness. This is what I call learning. If you create these, you know, they call it gamified learning. You know, if you create these games or these technologies that cut that part out of the learning process, the student is not integrating the logos and the pathos with their own ethos. They're just being downloaded. And if they're just being downloaded, then they're not conscious at all. And maybe they'll be good workers and maybe they'll have money and maybe there will be some kind of social stability. But I don't know that that's necessarily making the student you know, a fully developed mind and spirit, and, you know. I'll stop there.
Well, true. And I remember that we used to have to write essays, or we would have to actually give them feedback. You are taught a certain principle or a certain piece of information, or you read a book and then do a book report. And now they're not encouraged to do that kind of thing. I think that probably there are a lot of children in high school that can barely write a paragraph about something. It's not as required as it used to be.
Yeah, and as Orwell said, right, the language is intimately integrated with thought, right? I mean, you have to be able to think through a problem, you have to be able to dialogue with yourself in your own mind. And, it, you know, when I have, you know, when I read essays where a student's not aware that they've contradicted themselves fundamentally halfway through the paper, and we sit down and then you show them and you realize they really weren't aware that they did it, you know, like, oh, you're right, and then they need, you know, it's no wonder sometimes, you know, why, you know, there's all of the divisiveness in our country at this point, because, you know, people can't keep track of their own ideas, let alone, you know, the other side. And then when you get that inability to control your own emotions, your own pathos, you know, when words don't work, people get mean, you know.
Right. And your frontal lobe is the thinking part of your brain. Some people refer to it as the subconscious. In the back of the brain, you're kind of on automatic pilot. You don't have to think about how you don't have to think about your heart beating or your lungs working or that kind of thing. They work automatically. But you really have to engage the frontal lobes to really understand and think about something and to be able to do some critical thinking rather than just taking in questionable information. Because I don't think that children or students are really challenged to raise their hand and say, hey, wait, I don't believe this. And, of course, when you are in a group of people who are all expected to, oh, we'll pick this up on the other side. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Our guest is John Klycek, the author of Schoolwork Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. In your classical, well, who knows how classical it was, but in the traditional schoolroom, people were, they still practice a great degree of consensus thinking. There were some critical thinkers who would raise their hand and maybe ask questions about what was being presented, but they were less likely to. But now, you can't raise your hand and question something you're getting through a screen. There's no interaction. There's more consensus thinking, less critical thinking. The authority of the screen takes over everything. And I was going to ask you to talk about it in the next hour, chapter 11. And Team Trump and who you refer to, and many people refer to him as the Donald, but oh gosh, and Bilderberg and PayPal and Facebook, and they all sit on these various boards. They're all buddies. And it's no coincidence that they would all be buddies and meet in private rooms without the public's knowledge. And we certainly are not going to hear about it on the nightly news. So.
Yeah, one place where a lot of these, I'll call them big tech, big money, big tech people meet is, at the Bilderberg Group.
Right.
And I mentioned that quite a bit. And, you know, when I wasn't even aware that people were in it, I'd be writing and I says, you know what, let me just check. And they, you know, I was like, oh, so let me add that because so Zuckerberg has been there, Ray Kurzweil, who I talked about, if your people don't know, that's, chief of engineering at Google, been around. He's the reason why you have, voice recognition software and cochlear implants. I mean, he's super important in terms of the development of all this technology. Zuckerberg, obviously, CEO of Facebook, who's the PayPal guy that, Thiel.
Right.
That, Bilderberg again, Bezos was, I believe, at one of those.
Right.
And so, you know, yeah, I mean, which is again, you know, if you don't look at these things, if you don't look at stuff like Bilderberg, if you don't look at stuff like, you know, The Order, if you don't look at stuff like, the CFR, the CNP is another one, right? It's the right wing version of the CFR. You know, you're largely, what you look at might seem disparate. Right, it might seem like just random companies that are competing, and you know, but when you just add that other layer to it, and you're like, well, that's a pretty even continuity of people that kind of keep popping up the same places and change how you interpret it.
Right? Yeah, like it was a big coincidence. These people are all here. Oh gosh, what a coincidence. Ha ha. Okay, we're at the top of the hour. We will be right back and we will invite your phone calls. Be right back.
Listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest is John Klycek. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. The website is schoolworldorder.info. I highly recommend his book. It's fabulous. It's wonderful. Everyone should have a copy, whether you're a parent or not a parent. We are all part of this group of people that are being targeted. We're all in this together. Not just our children. And just because if you don't have children in school, you may have grandchildren in school. The children of this country are the future of this country, and our children are being impacted in such horrible ways. It just makes me sick. If you have a question, call into the program at 800-313-9443. And we're talking about Billionaires Behind Closed Doors, Chapter 11. And Betsy DeVos meets with Bilderberger Peter Thiel. And if you buy something from Amazon, or if you buy something from any online company, when you are online, you may find a pop-up on the side of your screen that shows maybe you bought something from Coldwater Creek. Then you're going to see an advertisement for Coldwater Creek. If you think you're not being tracked, online, then you're very naive. If you think that posting all your personal information on Facebook, if you really think that that's a good idea, you're an idiot. I'm sorry, you're just an idiot. I would never, when Facebook first came out, I thought, oh, what a nice idea to keep in touch with your family. I was on Facebook, I don't know, maybe a week, and I thought, this is such a time waster, my gosh. They're not gonna post something like, I feel like such a loser. Gosh, I did this wrong, I did that wrong. You're just gonna get people's good stories and it's not reality, people. It just, stay off of Facebook. Probably the CIA's running it. That sounds conspiratorial, but, the internet is fabulous. But they didn't design it to be fabulous for us. They designed it to be fabulous for them.
And it starts with, valuing, you know, yourself is a dignified human being. You know, I mean, you'd be surprised how many people don't even realize that, make that connection when they see that. And there's articles that we read, you know, I have my students read on, you know, data mining, and I'm like, you know, they're like, yeah, and you know, they'll say stuff like, I noticed, you know, I would go on and I'd buy something, and then later I'd be on Facebook and it would be there. I thought it was weird. And they said, well, you know, now you know what? And a lot of times the response is, well, you know, so what? I got an ad for something that I didn't know I could look for. And so, you know, I got offered a product I didn't otherwise know about. And the other response is, it's like, my data's, I'm not that important. My data's not that important. That's, you know, and if you're in that, you know, I mean, if you're in that place in your life, I mean, it's hard to convince you that it's not important, but, you know, it's, as long as you think that way, it won't be. But I says, you know, I was telling you, you know, there's a lot of people, these companies pay a lot of money for this information about you that you think is insignificant, and they make a lot of money. So maybe they think better, you know, more about you than you do. And, you know, I think, you know, it's just things that teachers told me that didn't click till years later, so who knows. But a lot of times they just kind of chuckle and like, oh, you know, big deal, you know, I got some extra ads on my website, you know. And
right. I had a friend that I was talking with. We were just all at the gym working out, and I mentioned that the government. And I learned, you have to learn who you can talk to about certain of these things, because some people don't, they're just not interested, they're just very naive. And I said, you know, sometimes people do listen in. There are agencies that do listen in on your phone calls. And this lady said, well, as long as you're not doing anything wrong, then you don't have to worry about it. Well, what you might be talking about might be proper and correct at that moment, but maybe 6 months from now, it's not going to be. The fact is that nobody should be surveilling you. You have a right, according to the Constitution, to have privacy within your homes. You have a right to privacy. That is being taken away from you, seized by the very technology that we've all come to adopt as being helpful to us. It's helpful, yes, it's helpful, but who is it helping the most? You or the people who are collecting information and making millions of dollars on information that they collect from you, about you?
Yeah, and I tell them, you know, it's not, well, first of all, you know, my favorite counterargument or rebuttal to that is, you know, why do you have locks on your doors? Is it because you're doing something bad, or is it because you want to keep bad people out? You know, I mean, the book that I wrote, I think is, you know, I did it for a humanitarian cause and for the good of, you know, learning, but there's some people that might not like it, you know, and so, you know, I don't know, you know, what kind of repercussions come from people that don't, you know, that otherwise disagree. So sometimes, yeah, you have a private world. It's not necessarily because you're duplicitous, but it's, you know, I like to get along with people that I disagree with, and we don't have to fight about stuff. You know, to have everything public would make it so you could never, you know, get along with people that you don't like with that one level. But another level is that I tell them it's not about the specific information that you're posting. It's about the patterns that you create. That's what big data is all about. An algorithm is, you know, simplified explanation, it's a pattern, right? It's it's data that goes in a specific pattern, and based on that pattern, they can predict where the pattern is going to go, basically. And right. You know, that's what it is. You know, I said, it's not the specific posts; it's all the different platforms you're using combined, and they basically have a psychological profile on you. Like, you know, they know stuff better than you know it. They know your habits better than you know it. You know, like when you know, you know, I use my Google Maps a lot because I'm bad with local geography. It'll tell me stuff like, hey, getting ready to, time to go home soon, you know, and it's like, okay, so, you know, some of this stuff is like, you know, it's super hard to avoid, so you have to minimize it as much as possible. But the problem with, you know, I mean, you can't necessarily avoid all of it, you know, I mean, you and I are probably being listened to right now, you know, but it's when it becomes a mandate as a policy that everybody has to comply with that it becomes extremely pernicious, especially. And, you know, that's, you know, it's one thing to voluntarily use a platform and you kind of take the risk. It's another thing to have it. You have to use it to get your degree, you know.
Right. And that is the situation that our children are currently involved in, is that they are pretty much forced to use the technology, because that is what is available. They don't have a choice about whether they want to attend third grade with a classical teacher-student relationship, or whether they want to attend with all the computers. And most people, most parents, naively say they want their children to have the best technology, not recognizing that that is the worst possible case scenario for their children. You talk about Bill Gates a lot, which Bill Gates does a lot of really bad stuff. And in your book, you say between 2008 and 2014, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation donated at least $60 million for virtual learning courseware. And from 2011 and 2015, the Gates Foundation paid out at least $5,322,000 in grants for adaptive learning software, while a foundation dumped $20 million into the 2014 Next Generation Courseware Challenge contest between following EdTech companies. And then you give a list of the companies. And Bill Gates, of course, is a member of the Bilderberg Group.
Yeah, well, that's the other one. Yeah, I knew there was one else, another big name I forgot. Sorry.
And when you think about this, that he does not allow his children to use the very technology that he is forcing on other people's children, you must question why that is. And look at the money of this person who claims that he developed this stuff in his garage. If you believe that, you're a total idiot. Sorry, you're a total idiot if you think he developed all this stuff in his garage.
Well, the Bill and Melinda Gates basically just, I don't want to say taken over, because the Rockefeller Foundation still does a lot. But I mean, as far as like, on the kind of like the one that gets a lot of publicity in the, on the mainstream eye, you know, when you hear about, oh, you know, this recent grant to help some big humanitarian project, it's usually Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I mean, I rarely see them say, hey, Rockefeller Foundation did something, you know, on the normal TV news. But Rockefeller largely started this whole nonprofit, you know, system of, you know, they call it non-profit. I'd call it tax exempt because the connotation right. implies it's right. Instead that, you know, it's really that it's a place for them to hide money and then also spend that money in ways to re-engineer markets and society in ways that, you know, help them continue to have monopolies.
And to make more money.
Yeah, right. You know, I mean, effectively, right? And you know, the Rockefeller Foundation started off with the General Education Board, and one of the main people that sat on that was Daniel Coyne Gilman. He was also on the Carnegie Foundation, but he's right. Order of Skull and Bones.
Right. And he was had something to do with the Historical Society, didn't he? Yeah.
That might have been White or Dwight. The three of them were like
twice.
But I, you know, off the top of my head, yes, one of them, the American Historical Society, was him or one of the other two. But what Gilman himself, I know, was he was sat on the board of the Carnegie Corporation. He sat on the board of the General Education Mental Health set up Johns Hopkins University.
Right.
And I believe Cornell. Now again, Cornell might have been one of those other three. But yeah, he set up with some of the most important colleges. When he was at Johns Hopkins, he also basically, set up, you know, became a eugenics curriculum. The inaugural speech was from Thomas Henry Huxley, which is, you know, Aldous Huxley's granddaddy.
Or somebody, yeah.
Yeah, his brother was Julian, and Julian was the guy that was president of the British Eugenics Society. He also was the first director general of the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, which is UNESCO for short. And you know, you can get the free PDF of UNESCO, its purpose and its philosophy, which is the founding document of UNESCO, the UNESCO Charter. And he talks about basically, you know, yeah, Hitler was bad, but we still need eugenics. And he talks about, you know, overpopulation and all that Malthusian stuff. But his buddy that helped, you know, when they worked on the UNESCO Constitution was another Bonesman, which is Archibald MacLeish. And so, you know, you have the order all tangled up in all that history as well.
Right. Right. Yes, I'm looking at your page 143 here. You also bring in Freemasonry, as well as, the Illuminati, Order Skull and Bones. This is just, and of course the UN, that is another organization that I think, oh gosh, isn't it wonderful? We can all just get together and everybody can get along with each other. But it's not going to happen.
UNESCO is where you get lifelong learning from, right?
Sure.
So, you know, you mentioned, you know, starting earlier and now going longer as far as, you know, traditional schooling is concerned. You know, John Gatto talked about that, you know,
right.
School largely designed to make you stay a child. And I gotta say that's pretty accurate just from my anecdotal experience and a lot. I feel like a lot of times I'm encouraged to do stuff that hinders students from taking more responsibility, which would make them better learners in my personal, you know, my humble opinion. You know, it seems like I do, you know, I'll do stuff every day like, you know, hey, let's check the syllabus and make sure we all know what we're doing today and next time. And it seems like the more I do stuff to help them keep, you know what I mean? If they know I'm doing it for them, so it seems like they lack more initiative, which is the danger of the stimulus response method, all that behaviorist operant conditioning stuff. It's, you know, you not only does it condition you to, you know, perform a particular behavior, it conditions you to become accustomed to this stimulus response. You know, this autonomy that where you shut off that front part of the brain.
Right.
I kind of take detours on accident sometimes. But what I just thought of is that, if anybody wants to check out that Joe Rogan interview with, Elon Musk, if you haven't seen it, you gotta see it just because this is, you know, this was like his little, Musk's prior introduction to his Neuralink, which is a brain chip. We call it a brain computer interface that he actually has a prototype for. You can look at his actual promo for the device. He shows you what it looks like. It's got these things called these graphene laces that go in your brain in different directions. It's really creepy looking. But he said that the internet is your id writ large, and he basically said that it's basically, or did he say it was the limbic system writ large, which is basically saying the same thing. The id is that, you know, is that under the passions, it's the, you know, the more animal base of your subconscious and all that. And he says that the internet is the limbic system is the bottom part of the brain, which is, you know, like you said, it's the amygdala and all that stuff. It's
right.
That your reptile brain. It's the reflex part. It's the fighter. It's the non-thinking part. It's the feeling part. And he says that largely the internet, that's what the internet is. And that's why we like things like Instagram more than, that's why we like images and videos more than text-based, because it saturates that lower level more than the thinking level, like, as you pointed out, a text, right? The text require, it's all abstract, so there's no image. You have to create the image based on all these abstract symbols, so you have to engage that frontal lobe in a way that you don't when you just have all these images literally downloaded into it. And so what he's saying is that his neural link is just going to basically, like, literally make it so you can literally download it. Like, just get that frontal lobe, that buffer out of the way is, you know, this kind of, is basically what he's saying, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
You know? Right.
And that to me is not learning, right? I mean, it might be outcomes-based education. It might produce a particular outcome, or what they call a competency now. It's a new buzzword, competency-based education, but it doesn't create an individual who can think, you know, on their own feet and have their own volition in terms of their own consciousness. And yeah.
Right. And back to addictions. What is the first thing that you do when you get up in the morning? A lot of people used to interact with their family. And now they're interacting with their cell phone, usually with people they've never met, will never meet, and they have to check their email. There were one of the books that I was reading told how many times people typically check their email or look at their cell phone today. I was just blown away. All righty. We'll be right back, and we will accept your phone calls at 800-313-9443. Be right back.
It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead. To change the bad to good.
All righty, welcome back. Our guest is John Klycek. He wrote a book that everyone should read. It's called School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. The website is schoolworldorder.info. If you would like to chat, ask a question, or make a comment, feel free to call 800-313-9443. Alrighty. What would you like to cover? There's so much in your book. It's just so well put together. I'm just really, really, it's a thrill to read your book. It's very educational and, troubling. It's not a thrill, it's troubling. But people need to know this. They need to know what they're doing. They need to know what's being done to them and to the children of our nation. The other thing, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, okay. My publisher says this. That's what the publisher is, Chris Milligan, you know, who, by the way, this is somebody that he published his own wrote and published his own book about Skull and Bones and
right.
know, he's New Sutton and helped republish that. So this is not a man that has a weak stomach. He says that, you know, it was, he said it several times to me that it was scary. And then that's what he put in his publisher's note, but not to scare people away. But, you know, it is scary. I mean, it's scary for me to think about. I mean, in the least element, cause you know, if it goes in the direction that I see it going, you know, I'll probably have a job. First is the first thing that'll happen. The second part is, you know, I mean, what will happen to consciousness itself when, you know, the empirical method is to measure. And, you know, what they're doing is with predictive analytics is they want to measure. This is what we were talking about with all the data tracking. They feel like if they can get a big enough data pool of all the stuff that happens, basically they can, you know, they can have predictive analytics. Well, it's my feeling that consciousness means to be able to basically have some sort of volition. And that means, you know, you're a being in time, so to speak, you know, to use a little Heidegger phrase. Not that I'm all into Heidegger, it's kind of weird in some ways, but you know, you're in time and space, and you're moving through time, and you can use your words to, you know, remember stuff and to abstract it, but you can also use your words and your language and your mind, your thoughts, to move forward in time and to have a will, right? You know what I mean? In other words, to make choices about how the future plays out. If you over measure everything, which is largely what all this is for, and to integrate, you know, it with, you know, making the workforce so-called stable, I just don't know where thought is left, right? If everything is sort of laid out for you, I don't know what that means for consciousness. And to me, that's scary. You know what I mean? Like maybe I'm a Luddite or something like that. Evolution. You know, let me just go ahead and play devil's advocate for a second. But I just, from my perspective, you know, I cannot see how that, I wouldn't want to be in that state of consciousness from my perspective in this state of consciousness, I guess. And so it's scary. It for sure is scary. But I feel like, you know, all it requires to stop or is to basically say, you know, to stop using the stuff. You know, it's really just, it's kind of simple in a lot of ways, you know, in some ways.
To use it in a way that it benefits you, to not use it as much as they would like to have it used. And the other thing is the book, whatever you are reading, whether it's your book or whether it's somebody else's book, whether you're reading stuff online, that you should not obsess over the things that you can do nothing about. But knowing about certain things, you can make choices for yourself. You can't change what is going on, but you can change your response to it. You can elect not to engage in something that other people are engaging in. You can make choices that are right for you. You do not have to participate in this stuff or worry about something that you cannot change.
Absolutely. That's the main thing. I mean, so I gave practical solutions systemically, like institutionally, what you could do for the school system. But at the end of the day, let's say that we're stuck with a bad system, the system we have, right? This flux of public-private battle between public schools and public-private charter schools. At the end of the day, there's plenty of ways for everybody to, you know, find their own, use that internet in a way where you can learn outside of the career pathway they want to put you on or to, you know, and I know that's not easy for people, you know, might not, like, you know, have that free thinking kind of inquisitive mind, and it might be a tall order, but it's also a simple one, right? It's taking responsibility.
Right. Don't let this frighten you, but know what's going on so you can make clear choices for yourself. Okay, we'll be right back.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead. to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you.
All right, we are back with our guest, John Klycek. If you wish to call into the program to ask a question or make a comment, the number is 800-313-9443. The other thing too is that that we become frightened by things that are happening. I do present some problems and some situations on my radio program, but I also try to address a solution and to have some solution to the problem. For instance, we might talk about 5G. You may not be able to stop 5G, but hey, let's get some help. How do we avoid the dangerous frequencies? How do we avoid getting cancer by carrying a cell phone in your back pocket, or women who carry their cell phone in their bra? How do we avoid the dangers out there? We must know what the dangers are so that we can avoid them. Correct?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and so I gave out some pretty, about a 5-point plan. I was going to say simple solutions. I mean, it's a monolith. It's a Leviathan, so it's none of it simple, but as simple as I could, you know, make them. So one is, you know, to maintain local public control of your schools. That means to maintain your local school boards, right? I mean, that means you should, you know, you can't be taking these public-private, you know, charter school reforms, we'll just call them, okay? You know, there's other than the fact that it's, you know, what we said about funneling, you know, students into a workforce caste system, will essentially remove any agency families have in basically saying, hey, we don't like this policy, we do like this policy. You know, the local school board has its problems, just like, you know, just like unions have their problems, just like government has its problems, but it's there, it's meant for us to use it for our advantage. And so if you give, you know, if you give up the school board, it would be like saying, well, Congress disagrees all the time, so let's just have a president. And it's like, no, we need to have, you know, some buffer so that we can actually, you know, voice our opinions through some kind of representative. The second goal, or the second point, is to abolish the stimulus response methods. This means, you know, not just at the high-tech level with the adaptive learning software and all that stuff. It also means, you know, just that as a pedagogy or as a teaching philosophy, that the goal of teaching is to get required outcomes. I mean, obviously there's certain things, I want my students to understand the difference between ethos, logos, and pathos, but, you know, I never tell them what argument to make. You know, I tell them, as long as you don't contradict yourself within the scope of your paper and you're able to provide me some evidence, you know, and it's cohesive in the short, which is not hard to do in the 3 pages. Double space, you know, you're good. The stimulus response, outcomes-based, competency-based, all that stuff, it needs to be removed. And then, so along with that is, the third point would be to protect student privacy. And so that means, along with any of these technologies, any of this digital stuff, whether we're talking about the adaptive learning software, which is basically just a little screen with a module where, you know, it asks you some questions and you kind of type your response to it. It might have some videos that you interact with and then you respond, et cetera. Or it could be something as high tech as, you know, like an automated bot that acts as a tutor or a teacher, or it could be something like, you know, down the pipe, like a Neuralink chip that helps you, you know, download stuff. All of that stuff requires data to be tracked, right? Because these are communications technologies, right? They have to send and receive. In order for it to be able to do that with a constantly changing environment, it has to keep track of the data going in and out. And so, you know, that has to be removed, okay? There's things like the, you know, I think it's Pupil Protection and Privacy Rights Act, that might have some, you know, the parents might be able to use, but that should be an issue at, you know, local school board debates, you know, like, you know, for all these people that want cell, social emotional learning stuff, like, you know, what they're not saying is that comes with a lot of data tracking. So for all the parents that feel like their children might need some help emotionally, maybe they do, ubiquitous data tracking is not going to give them the help that you think it is. And so that should be thrown out of the window before you even have that debate. So far I said local control, public control, okay, of the school boards, no stimulus response, no ed psych, educational psychology, unless someone has a legitimate disability, but those types of tests should be done outside the school with a legitimate medical professional with HIPAA, protections and all that. It shouldn't be this public-private smorgasbord of, you know, the student, or the teacher acting as the nurse and, you know,
right.
You know, all this data is just flowing around because, you know, we're all working together to be more efficient with the outcomes.
Right.
The other two, I would say, so, you know, those are the things I, you know, don't do, those are kind of the no-nos. So then what to do? You know, I promote a classical reform, a classical curriculum, you know. You know, we don't teach, you know, the what was once called the trivium, you know. I mean, yes, it has a lot of jargon, Greek jargon, Latin jargon. But the simple idea of grammar, and not just grammar as, you know, sentence structure, but as the basic concept of subject specific formal logic, which we don't have anymore, basically. I don't teach formal logic really at all. And then rhetoric. You know, I didn't get rhetoric till I was, my later years in college, me personally. And a lot of the classical learning stuff I actually kind of dug up as I wrote the book. And kind of, you know, changed some things, which helped me. Because I had some places they really discourage grammar. I don't know if, I believe you know that.
Right.
And so, in a lot of ways, I think they've cut off some of the trunk or the roots that built this branch that is the current education system. And I think that's the classical curriculum. You know, and some of that means, the second part of that means, you know, not just philosophy at an early age, but, you know, metaphysics at an early age. You know, if you're going to have some kind of if there's going to be a democracy or a republic in which people can get along under some objective standard that is not the state or a company, it's going to have to be a transcendent value. And that transcendent value, you know, it's going to be a first cause, metaphysical, and, you know, it's going to be spiritual, but it at least has to be, you know, for those that you know, might want to disagree about that, it still has to be metaphysical in the sense that it's not the state that decides what's right and wrong, and it's not the companies that decide wrong, or I guess they would just say most efficient. It has to be something transcendent, some value, and we can debate about this, and this can be what the education system kind of looks at. We can look at all the classical texts and see what everybody says, and, you know, but I think that if we all agree that we're supposed to, you know, in this society, be able to, like, make our own destinies, I think everybody can probably agree to that. Everybody wants to choose their own destiny at some level, okay? That's gonna require us all to have, so there has to be something in between us that nobody can control with either government or business. And so, you know, I think the way to get back to that is through classical reform and a removal of the high tech and educational psychology stuff, you know. I probably said, yeah.
Yeah. And it's been thrown at us so incrementally that when you think back to, for instance, the 1990s, and think about how what you had then what your experience was then as opposed to what it is now, then it's just drastically different. And the other thing too is that once a population accepts something as morally correct or normal, it's very difficult to backtrack. For instance, there are people now who have never experienced or never questioned the morality of, for instance, abortion. It's a given to some people that abortion has all, they've always known that that was legal, but you have to ask, just because something is legal doesn't mean that it's moral. And you can apply that to any other subject. Just because something is legal, just because the government now says that it's legal for them to collect data on you, to take away your privacy, to force you to purchase things that you do not need, do not want, just because somebody has made a law, can they force you to, for instance, put a smart meter on your home to collect data about what you're doing? And that is exactly what a smart meter does. Or if they impose any kind of technology on you that compromises your right to privacy in your home, you should not be accepting of that.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to go back to something you had said earlier, which was how a lot of this, you know, often parents feel like, well, I want my son or daughter to have the best education. And you know, it kind of just is a presumption that, well, that means that the best education, it's got to have the best technology. Because technology, you know, is new, and it is the cutting edge of human civilization. And so, if anything is the best, it's gotta have really good technology. And you know, and that's part of this dichotomy that, well, if it's old stuff like classical learning, that's gotta be backwards, and we should just get rid of it. And so, along with that comes literally a faith in technology. And I mean, like, that is the transcendent value. The day, like, the algorithm that this AI can calculate beyond any human brain is like, well, hey, who are we to question it? Cause we're just little brains, but it's super AI. And so now you're in a situation where, you know, you can't even, you know, you can have a debate about transcendent values that come from God or nature or spiritual forces, but, you know, I mean, when that AI, when that algorithm basically has the weight of a transcendent spiritual value, I mean, but it also has the weight of empirical data. I mean, I wonder what it will be like for younger people who grow up under it. Like, you know, you and I have lived in a world without that, so we can go, that's, you know, we can question it, but if you're always just, you know what I mean? That will be
right.
Yeah.
Right. What people experience is what they believe to be normal and correct. But that's not always been the case. But people are not encouraged to evaluate history or to look at how things were done 20 or 30 years previously. It is just, people don't question enough. There's not enough critical thinking. The school systems do not encourage any kind of critical thinking. They are programming you. Education is basically a program to a schedule to program your mind to accommodate people that you've never met, people that you've only heard about, people who give large amounts of money so that they look wonderful and they think, oh gosh, oh what a nice guy. He's given all this money to help us. When in fact, they wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't of some benefit to them. And of course you have to look and see what they're doing within their own family. So you have to do some critical thinking, some investigation, some reading of a book such as the one that you have written.
You know, and a darker side of that too is that it's, you know, not only do the algorithms become your values. I mean, you know, once you were to be a little philosophical for a second, we're talking about the difference between the a priori and the a posteriori, which just means the second one is what we talked about, measurement. It's science, it's empiricism. But the a priori is usually associated with spiritual stuff, but it means that you have a value that you start with before you experience stuff. So in other words, you have a value that you have before the algorithm tells you something. You can say,
right,
well, my value says this. You know, it disagrees with the algorithm. But when the algorithm becomes the value, there's no way to get out of the algorithm. But the darker part about it is that, you are improving the algorithm every time you interface with it. Every time you do something.
Right.
It's not teaching you, you are teaching it. And so are the students. And that is the worst part about it to me. You know, and me too, as you know, I have to use the stuff. You know, I have to use the learning management software, and I'm sure that it has some data tracking corpus in it. You know, I mean, I have to use different ones at different schools. You know, me as well. You know, I mean, if you're in a school, you kind of are participating in it, you know, and so, so as a solution, then, you know, that's, you know, people just need to, I know if we're kind of down the road a little bit here with these devices, but we gotta start at least, you know, I mean, start on, that's what we were saying, you know, aside from the 5 points, on an individual level, I mean, just find ways to use these things less or to shut down some of the tracking they have on it. I mean, don't do their work for them is what I say.
Right. We've all fallen victim, to them because we are using the very technology that is so damaging to us personally. Okay, we will be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today, I can't believe we've spent almost 3 hours visiting. It has just flown by.
It's been fun. Yeah.
It has been joyful to have you on the program.
Well,
disturbing, but reading your book. Yes. It really is a must read, and I hope that people will purchase the book, that they will read it, share it. Christmas is coming up. Buy a copy for your relative or something. Anyway, what are some closing thoughts that you might wish to share with us?
I would like to share, with the closing minutes, first I want to make sure I get this in, which is I want to thank Charlotte Thompson Iserby and Chris Milligan again for everything, and I want to note Anthony Sutton's great work because, you know, as much as I wrote this because of the content that it is and the issue that it is, it's been an honor to work with those two and to carry on their work, including Sutton's, and to have them work with me pretty much every step of the way. Charlotte reached out just as a, you know, out of nowhere, and we're good friends now. And she's just a great person aside from, you know, all her research, which is amazing. You can go to deliberatedumbingdown.com, is her website, which is on my website. You can, there's a link to it there. And her book, her whole book is free online. Is
right.
Mine. So if you want back, you know, any background research, you know, I kind of synthesized what Charlotte wrote and Sutton wrote, and I added, you know, I did the history there, and I added the future of where it's kind of going with all the stuff we talked about. So those resources are good to have, you know, after you read the book or with the book, because it really is what I think is a synthesis and a sequel to those. Otherwise, I want to say thank you again for having me on. This has been fun. I feel like those are the most important things. Is there anything? I know we got like a minute left. Is there anything else you can think of, or is that a good way to cut out here?
No, I think that like I say, it's been wonderful having you on the program. And there are, despite the fact that you have told us these, written about these things that you've written about, we still have personal choices. We still have the ability to make application of the things that you've written, or to reject the things that you've reject those things in our own lives. We can make choices. We still have free agency. We can say no and make choices that are good for our family. And I think that that's what we need to do, is to educate ourselves, which you have done. You've provided a wonderful education for those who read your book. And we can take the information in your book, and it can scare us, or we can do something about it in our own lives. So, thank you so much, John. It's been fun.
A little bit of good is way better than a lot of evil. Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Chat with you next week. Take care. Have a lovely week.
Thanks.